When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The book was originally a memoir about coming to America. My life and everything got much more complicated. So I put a lot of stuff in the book to show you my history and how it connects to what's happening right now. So my history was growing up with a guy in Cuba, Fidel Castro. And from the first time that I heard Trump speak back in the primaries, I was like, wow, this sounds just like the things Castro said. This is pretty dangerous. My name is Edel Rodriguez, and I'm a modern minority.
Welcome to Modern Minorities.
This is a show about work and life, told through the lens of what makes each of us different.
I'm Sharon Lee Tony, a Chinese-American girl born and raised in New York City.
And I'm Raman Segal, an Indian-American boy who came from Alabama with a banjo on my knee.
Through conversations with some really interesting people, we uncover the stories, perspectives, and often unspoken truths about how our guests uniquely experience the world.
It doesn't matter where you're from, the color of your skin, or who you love. We're all minorities somehow, but we're no one's model minority.
This is a show about all of you for all of us.
On today's show, we're talking to Cuban-American artist, activist, and graphic novel author Edel Rodriguez. Edel has created more than 200 magazine covers for the likes of The New Yorker and Time Magazine, Newsweek, and Der Spiegel, which, as one NPR journalist recently said, singular, striking, and often controversial. I guarantee you've seen some of Edel's work in the Trump era of American politics. Just Google Edel Rodriguez magazine cover and you'll see what I'm talking about. Edel's latest work is his graphic memoir, Worm, a Cuban-American Odyssey, that tells the story of his childhood in Cuba and his family's decision in 1980 to join the hazardous flotilla of refugees known as the Marianne Boatlift. The graphic novel only just came out in November, and I kind of accidentally discovered it. But once I started reading it, I could not put it down. You guys know I read a lot of comics, and this might just be one of, if not the best graphic novel that I read in 2023. So I had to reach out to Edel for a chat. After all, got a podcast. In Worm, which is a term that Fidel Castro used for Cubans who chose to leave the country, Edel uses his own life to capture not just what it's like to grow up under an authoritarian government, but also to sound a caution from the run-up to the election of 2016 to January 6, 2020, the future we are facing in this election year. So beyond Edel's personal story, which I'd highly recommend you read in his graphic memoir, I really wanted to get at the why for his activism and storytelling approach. So let's get right into our chat with our new friend Edel. Edel, thank you so much for coming on the pod. It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
So for folks who may or may not have read your book, which I'm obviously a very new fan of, I don't know, do you ever get asked, where are you from?
Yeah, actually, that's partly how the book came about. Yeah. Whenever I met editors in conversations, probably about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, they were like, you know, so where are you from? And then in that conversation, I would share where I'm from and a bit of my story. And immediately I would hear, that's a book.
Well, but what's the quick answer? Like when you're just at a party with your, mm-hmm. with your friends, with your wife on the street, what's the quick answer? Do you say Miami? Do you say New York, New Jersey?
No, I would say, where I'm from, I would say Cuba.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Havana, Cuba or, Cuba.
Yeah.
I usually go, you know, you go back to the beginning, at least in my mind. Uh-huh. I wouldn't say I'm from Miami. That would be the second or third uh-huh. option. And in New Jersey is where I have my body happens to be at right now, but it is not like I don't feel where I'm from is where I'm originally from.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, because you're from El Gabriel, mm-hmm. right? Like,
yeah.
Can you, obviously you read the book, there's so many stories, but what's one of those kind of stories from your youth? And it doesn't have to be so much about the message of the book, but just what's a story from growing up? What's one of those things that you remember the most?
I think that what I remember the most were stories of just playing out in the streets with my friends, I took for granted back then, but now living in the United States, you just don't see that much of that happening. So mm-hmm. we lived in the street, you know, playing games and you know, hunting for birds with, you know, slingshots and it's just wild kids roaming around like shirtless and shorts and barefoot, you know, which no kids run around barefoot anymore. That is what I remember of my youth.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to say it's this idyllic youth. It's just was the youth that you knew.
Right.
But so much of the book talks about the perspective of your parents and what they had during your youth. And can you, I mean, there was like this fear of your youth for you and your sister that your parents were slowly kind of realizing. When did that start to realize the experience your parents were having versus yours? When did you start to realize the difference between those two things?
I honestly wasn't that aware of what was happening because I think that my in terms of politics, and I know I was surrounded by it, but I was, you know, living it in it. So I didn't
fish in water.
Yeah. Right? I didn't really have an outside perspective, but my father had lived before the revolution, you know, when Cuba was, you know, a functioning like democratic state, even though it was a ton of corruption.
Yeah.
But it was more, there were goods in the stores, there were, you know, imports, you know, so it was a flowing economy and he knew that. So when the revolution came in and then all of a sudden there were all these rules and these things that the kids had to do. And, you know, he never, you know, saluted a government in school. You know, it was just, so he
was his own man.
Yeah. Right? He was seeing things. He saw things in a different perspective. And that's when him and my mother started having conversations about what to do with this, because he was mostly concerned about us growing up and becoming part of a system that he didn't like, mm-hmm. or serving a system that he didn't think was human. And the idea that I would have to be sent into the military to fight overseas, or that my sister was caught up in administration issues at school.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what they felt that they were kind of losing their children to the state.
Do you think that was the tipping point? Because for a while, when you read your work, it's your dad's making do. Your mom and dad are kind of behaving a way they're supposed to, but at the same time on the edges, still kind of being his own man with the entrepreneurial stuff, with the photography, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of making do. In fact, I think in the book, your mom makes the arguments that, hey, we got this. It'll be fine. We'll get to Spain somehow.
Yeah.
What was the tipping point? You and your sister?
Yeah, it was twofold. It was us and what was happening mostly with my sister, because she was a bit older and they were already being, she was being kind of treated differently or restricted at school because the teachers and the government knew that we were trying to leave through Spain. And the other part was my dad was, he felt pressure that he was going to, be jailed or be punished for some of the work that he was doing, you know, in black marketing and trying to get materials for his photography business and other things. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of spying going on of our family for basically trying to figure out ways to get by. We weren't the only ones. There were other ones that were also being hit that. And all those pressures came to a head. And my father just thought, well, if we try to leave through Spain, that could take 3, 4, 5 years, or it could get caught up in problems. And then here came this boat lift where we could just jump on a boat and get out of here as soon as possible.
Yeah. I mean, the images in your illustration and the storytelling is just so visceral and vivid. How much of that is retelling what's in your mind, or is it reinforced memory of kind of the things you piece together from hearing what your dad said, what your mom said, what everyone was saying?
Again, it's a combination of things. You know, it's sort of from the time that I left and I grew up in Miami in the 80s, I kept processing these images, like, why did we leave? What's going on? Trying to understand the politics of it all.
Yeah.
But also had those moments kind of ingrained in my mind. But at the same time, I felt like I needed to match them up to realities, mm-hmm. of what was happening in the world and the Cold War and the news, and also the reality, mm-hmm. of my parents' life. And that's when I sat down with both of them and started having interviews.
Yeah.
So I can get to the actual reasons they left. I think we see immigrants arrive here and we don't really understand why they're here or the reasons. We just say, oh, there's immigrants, there's 2,000 of them at the border, we got to deal with them. It's almost, immigrants here are treated like a problem. And I wanted to explain all, you know, everything that goes into someone finally leaving their country. So people would
It's a heavy decision.
Yeah. So people would have more empathy for them. That was my concept for this.
The boat lift itself, right? The moment your parents make the decision, your family in Miami, you know, getting things all the setup, all the arrangements that start to happen, the experience of it, like the camps and the boat lift itself. How much of that, because that happened to you. I mean, you were an adolescent. Mm-hmm. You were probably around the same age as my kids when this happened.
Yeah.
How old were you when the boat lift happened?
Eight. I was eight.
How much of that is it like ingrained in your memory, or it's just this big kind of dreamlike thing that happened?
Yeah. I mean, it never feels dreamlike at all. It feels very specific, mm-hmm. you know, somewhere between the specific and the dreamlike, because the specific are the little details, you know?
Yeah.
And the dreamlike is the fact where you look back and you go, that really happened. You know, it was such an odd time.
Yeah.
No, so I wanted to capture the dreamlike imagery and things, but also get into how you specifically go from here to there. Oh, the paperwork that was taken from us and that made us kind of undocumented for a while there.
Yeah, because they took away your passports.
We were just basically left in a camp with nothing. We had no ID, no information about us, and told that we were going to be taken to a boat eventually, and then we're there in that camp forever. So we couldn't really go back home, and we were kind of in a detention camp, mm-hmm. you know, so that's what it was.
I mean, your work is to me, it was so moving. It's like the same level of books like Night, Mouse, Year of the Rabbit, you know, Best We Could Do. You're not a graphic novelist. You're an artist and an activist first. So what brought you to the medium of comics? Was it just once you started interviewing your parents?
Yeah, it was actually, I felt that it was the best way to tell my story and to tell this story, you know. Mm-hmm. There have been a few books about the boat lift, Before Night Falls by Reynaldo Arenas, a book called Finding Mañana by another Cuban author, but they're written as memoir, you know, in text. And I felt, well, okay, so that's already kind of been done. I wanted to do something that was visual, so it would have an impact on people that maybe don't pick up a novel to read, or a younger generation, so that are really into graphic novels. So they can understand and see the imagery. I think it really makes an impact when you see what occurred in Cuba. I think you can maybe dismiss it if it's in written form, but once you actually see what was done to people down there, I think a lot of people in this country would pay more attention to it. So that was part of the reason for the graphic novel. The other thing is that I draw for a living, so I think people would just expect that. But yes, I was not. I've never been a like, you know, I didn't grow up with comic books in Cuba, definitely.
Yeah.
So once I arrived here, I wasn't really into comics like a lot of my friends were. I mean, I would pick up some comics, you know, casually, but they also cost money. We didn't have any money mm-hmm. in Miami, and so there was no extra cash to go down to the comic shop. So I've never, but I as I grew older, I did, you know, become interested in reading some graphic novels, but I've not been like fully into that world.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, I grew up, obviously, all the usual flavors of X-Men, Fantastic Four, Batman, that stuff. But, mm-hmm. and that's kind of where the openness to the medium came. But in kind of mm-hmm. 20s and 30s, start to realize more stories can be told. And I feel like it's a medium that's somewhere between literature and film. But mm-hmm. where it wins in my heart is film. It's kind of a moving picture that just kind of washes over you. And, you know, in literature, you have to read and imagine it in your mind, but you're illustrating these points and you can get stuck on a page, kind of poetry, right? Like five lines of a poem.
Well, that's what I'm glad you said. That's what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know? So my issue sometimes with graphic novels is they feel too airy, right? Like you open a page and it's like the sun came in, and then it feels like too much about a reason to make drawings that you want to make. And the story can sometimes be a bit thin. Mm-hmm. So I wanted a book that you actually spent a while on that spread reading the details of you know, politics and family and emotions. and not sort of breeze through it.
Yeah, this is a heavy meal, man. This is like a red steak.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, are people going to really go for this? And I've been like really surprised that a lot of people really are loving reading it, and also that the comics book folks have gotten in touch with. This is amazing. It's like a new way of doing a graphic novel, which is much more, you know, beefy, you know. And it's been great, because I actually thought, oh my God, you know, the comics folks are just going to be tearing into it. But it hasn't been that way. It's been very welcoming, and reviews of it from people that read comics regularly. So that's great to see.
Yeah. I mean, your work in this book is, you know, it's mostly monochromatic. It's mostly black and white with one exception. And I want to talk about that. The use of red, and honestly, later orange, right? Towards the end of the book.
Right.
I think I know where you were going with the use of both of those, but can you talk to me about those choices? Was it intentional that certain people were red and others were not?
Well, the red was so much of my childhood was that, you know, definitely like the earth in my town is very deep red, reddish brown. So that was good. You know, my father's car was red. But then also the color of communism has always been attached with red. And my uniform, my communist school uniform was also red and white. So that made sense for the beginning of the book. But then I saw, wow, it really does translate into other places throughout the book. And then I like minimal color. And I added a little bit, like a shade of the red for when I arrived in Miami to create this pink color.
Yeah.
Because it's Miami. I'm like, I can't do harsh red here. And then when I got to the chapters about Trump, you know, I brought in the orange because it so much of my work I'm known as creating this character that invaded our consciousness by using this one orange color. So I felt I really wanted to do that there. And I like how it throughout the book just gives you a little bit more, a little bit, you know, doesn't go into full color, but it gives you a little something different as you go through the book.
Yeah. I mean, you alluded to your work about Trump in the era that we're living in. You know, I'd seen a lot of your magazine covers over the past several years, but I never connected them to the name behind the work. So I never was familiar with you as an artist until reading this comic. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you like that, right? But not knowing the history of your art, right? Was it the rise of Trump that drove your art activism, or was that something you were always doing because of how you grew up?
No, I've always been doing work about, you know, activist work or political, I call it more like political art or political graphics, going back to pretty much college at Pratt in Brooklyn. Then when I graduated, I began doing a lot of op-eds for the New York Times that mostly dealt with political issues. Mm-hmm. And working at Time Magazine, I created a lot of political, you know, tinge graphics for the magazine and for many other clients. It was around 2014 that I started saw that I could use the internet to kind of get my work out there as to how I felt issues should be treated, rather than sometimes the media does very neutral points of view on, you know, both sidism. Mm-hmm. That was with work dealing with terrorism and ISIS, and then immediately the Trump years appeared, and I continued that sort of online activism regarding what Trump was doing, and then it sort of went on from there. So it took off a lot, probably around 2015, 2016. But I had been doing political illustrations for many years.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing both sidesism of your work. For those listening right now, like literally you're on your phone, just do a quick Google for, you know, Ido Rodriguez magazine cover or Time cover. And these are stark, provocative statements, which, you know, ring true, right? To the thing we were all feeling. And I didn't see your book was going to go there because, again, I didn't know who you were when I first picked up Worm. Mm-hmm. You know, you make the jump to the present day and to your activism in the current day. And obviously your entire life story leads up to the reason you get to say this, the reason you have a unique point of view and vantage point. You know, it's funny right before we record, I was like, I promise I'm not going to get fanboy about the comic, but I didn't mean to get political, but can you talk about the parallels between Castro and Trump? Because we're in an election year when this episode is going to air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's so many of them. And I mean, I partly, the book was originally, I started about 10 years ago. It was going to be a memoir about coming to America, right?
Right.
A feel good story.
Yeah.
That was the book. And then my life and everything got much more complicated. So book evolved as history was evolving, you know, over the last 6 years. And, you know, one of the, when I started making my work, my magazine covers, everyone's questions, what is this? Where did this come from? Why are you doing this? Right. So I you know, put a lot of stuff in the book to show you, you know, to show this is the history. This is my history and how it connects to what's happening right now. So my history was growing up with a guy in Cuba, Fidel Castro, that would call people worms simply because they were against him or wanted to leave the country. And he would say it in speeches.
Yeah.
Now, actually, someone that I just met yesterday, Michael Arndt, a designer, pointed out that the word vermin, which Trump just used, comes from the Latin ver, which is worm. So there are these constant similarities, like using words like worm or vermin, saying the press is the enemy people, pointing out people in crowds and goading their fans to go beat them up. It goes on and on. And from the first time that I heard Trump speak back in 2015 in the primaries, I was like, wow, this sounds just like the things Castro said. This is pretty dangerous stuff. And I thought that we were treating Trump as a joke, mm-hmm. right, in this country. Like the media was just lapping it up, thinking it was crazy, wild. And I'm like, this is crazy and wild and funny. It's extremely dangerous. So I took it upon me to start making images that would show people that follow, not just people follow my work, but others in the media and people that follow my work, by their nature are art directors, designers, editors, mm-hmm. who I've known for 15, 20 years. And if I put stuff in front of their faces, they would, you know, get a hint that this was a much more serious thing happening and perhaps hire me to do work like that for their magazine. And eventually that came to be. That's a very hard thing to do in this country, to get the media to actually be hardcore and critical in a tough way, because especially in the middle of primary season and all that, because we've always treated all candidates in this sort of like neutral way. And I was like, you know, I don't think this is the time for the media to be neutral here. You really have to stand and stand up for freedom of the press.
Yeah, our way of life is at stake.
Our way of life. And as I was doing this, you know, myself, I'm thinking, wait, am I going too far here? What am I doing? I felt something, but I also, you know, as a human, think, well, I don't want to take advantage of my powers, and my powers being art and image making. But when finally the election happened in 2020, and I saw how he dealt with that result, and then the attack on Congress by him telling people to do that, mm-hmm. then I felt vindicated. I'm like, okay, there is everything I've been talking about for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, and then putting it finally into a book, I felt totally at ease with it all.
You know, he gets elected. So many things happen, Charlottesville, et cetera. And, you know, you're not on the fringes anymore. You're on the cover of Time. You're on the cover of Der Spiegel. And again, people listening, like, just Google these images really quick. You'll see them. You'll recognize them. You'll feel the visceral gut punch of, oh shit, he's right. You know, that was my reaction when I saw these covers
right
before I knew who you were, you know. What now? Like, okay, we're marching towards this again. It almost seems inevitable.
I think we're in a very dangerous time, more dangerous than before, because this country, having witnessed what happened on mm-hmm. January 6, 2021, where there was basically a coup attempt, is considering by Democratic vote voting the same guy to go in and do the same thing. So it tells you that a lot of people are okay with this. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are okay with a coup attempt.
Yeah, I mean, dude, for me, it was, you know, 9/11 was scary. I was in my 20s, but that was from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. January 6th was a scarier day for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I didn't recognize, and there's always been those elements of my country, even, you know, during the Trump era. But yeah, that was arguably one of the scariest days for me.
Yeah. And now you look at all these people and not just the voters, but the politicians are just, yeah, well, it's okay. We can, you know, like sweep to the side. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what people don't necessarily understand is that these, you know, movements, say like the Cuban Revolution and takeover of a dictator. There's been a dictator in Cuba for 60 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Nazi Party and
the National Socialist Party in Germany.
All of these things took they don't happen overnight. They take 10 years to develop, right?
Yeah.
The 30s, that's what Germany was going through. Cuba in the early 50s is when the Castro started to try to get power, but then he was jailed and sent to Mexico. He regrouped, he came back. So this is a process. So we're like in the middle of a process right now, you know? And I think people think that January 6th was just a random event. No, this is the way that Trump and his followers and Republicans want to function. Let's say, what if he becomes president again, and who knows what he does, but then what happens at the 4-year mark where he has to run again? You think he's going to have an election?
Yeah.
You know, so it takes a long time. And that's how countries get changed forever. And I think we're just taking it, not taking it as seriously as we should.
Yeah, yeah. History has a way of repeating itself, but we sometimes think we're better now. We know more now. We're so much more involved.
I do think there's like an American hubris about everything. But in this case, it's this American feeling. Well, it's not going to happen here. We're not that. You know, we're not that. And let's take another risk.
Yeah.
Let's take it to the edge again and see if we can, you know, I don't understand if someone was like, worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, you know.
I got to ask kind of a related question. So look, no diaspora is a monolith, right? Indian Americans don't all think the same way. Black Americans don't think the same way. And Cuban Americans, by no measure, also vote down the same kind of like path. There's such a diversity of point of views within the Cuban American diaspora, depending on when you came over, how you came over, but across the political spectrum. And something that really kind of resonated with me is in the height of your Trump era activism, you talk about your parents' reaction mm-hmm. to your work, specifically your mom. And I think about in the Indian American community, you know, how people are reacting to Modi, depending on what generation, when you came over, were you born here, were you born there?
Right.
There's just a complete family's not talking to each other. I literally stopped using WhatsApp in my family groups because of this, right?
Okay.
How has that been playing out, you know, with your parents, their reaction to your magazine covers, their reaction to this graphic novel? I mean, start small with your family, with your parents, and then what's been your observation of
right.
of your community?
Well, and one thing is in the book is one time where I had just made an, I think it was a new Trump cover for Time or something like that. And I had put it up on Facebook, and within like a minute, my mom called me, and her first question is, when did you become a cheap artist?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, you know, mom,
yeah.
you know, and I hung up on her, and then I unfriended her from Facebook.
Wow.
It's basically like, you don't have the right to look at my work if what you're going to be doing is calling me out of the blue and, you know, doing that.
And then again, and worth noting, like not just any parent, and we're both parents, you do anything for your children. We have these expectations.
Right.
But revisit what we just talked about 20 minutes ago. Your parents, everything on the line for you guys, right?
Right.
So the connection is deep.
Yeah, yeah. And no, of course. But I think, you know, there's other things involved. She probably didn't want me to be doing things that caused, you know, would bring me danger. I think that was one of her concerns. So, you know, there's no way to know exactly the reasonings for why parents do things sometimes. But that's what occurred. So, but we eventually started talking again. And then, you know, again, as you say, that the population is split, you know, like something, I think it says 55, 45, 65, 60, 40 or something. But within people themselves, they're split. They change their minds all the time. And that's the thing that's different sometimes, at least within the Cuban population, as opposed to sometimes America. Americans are very set in their, I am this, I am Republican, I am a Democrat for life.
And I gotta probe there. When you say Americans, do you mean like multi-generational Americans?
Like people that have been here for a long time.
Their parents, their grandparents, or great-grandparents, they've been here for a while.
Yeah, you know, my wife's family been here, was, you know, since probably the early 19th century or 40s. But they're set in the political ways, that's it. Mm-hmm. My family just goes back and forth all the time. You know, they'll vote one way, then they'll vote another. So within a few years, my mother started seeing that there was a problem in this guy. I think COVID, the way he treated COVID, woke up their eye, you know, woke them up, because it affected them because they're older people. And then the insurrection was the final, you know, nail in the coffin, that it's like, well, this wrong way to go. You know, so they might vote Democrat now or not.
Something you said in your book, it was so profound. Because of what they lived through, right? One party coming into power,
yeah.
Castro. I don't know if you're talking about your parents or Cubans. Like,
this is my sister, and my sister is that, yeah.
They just switch who they're voting for every time, because you never want any one party to have power.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to her once, and she's like, I don't really pay attention to the topics. I just don't want another dictator, so I vote for the opposite party all the time.
Wow.
So everyone has their own kind of ways they deal with the way they vote, which is fine. But you know, overall, and what I trying to explain to people here is that as they try to understand the Cuban diaspora and what's happening in Miami, and we get to the name of this podcast, the minority, modern minorities. So this idea that Cubans, so from the outside in, is this idea, Cubans are minorities. Why would they not vote with the minority? And you are assuming that we think of ourselves as minorities, and we don't. Cubans, especially those who are white or appear white or whatever, my family was always white. We were white people living in Cuba. We came to Miami. We were white families, et cetera, et cetera. I never felt like a minority because I was a majority in Cuba. We were all Cuban.
Yep.
I was a majority. We were a majority in Miami. Mm-hmm. So the power center of the majority in Miami is Cubans. It's only when I came up here that I was
to New York.
To New York City and college at Pratt. It's like, would you like to be at the Minority Students League or something? I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not a minority. Oh, yes, you are. You're a Latino. And I'm like, oh, I don't even feel like a Latino. I'm just Cuban, you know?
Yeah.
So there isn't that sort of thinking down there. They vote as a majority white people,
yeah.
You know, which is not very different from Georgia or from Texas or from, say, a family in Wisconsin whose entire lineage goes back to Sweden or Switzerland or whatever. My family's lineage pretty much goes to Spain, except for maybe there's some indigenous family member, Cuban indigenous. So there's a misunderstanding, or I think this country, the United States, tries to label everyone all the time, you know? So it's minority, or it's AAPI, or it's this, or it's that, or POC. And I have friends that are black and they're like, do not call me a POC. I am not a POC. I'm a black man.
Yeah.
My black man experience is different from an Asian person's experience. And I think I would like this country, the United States, to start talking about people and groups as who they are, not as these vast collections of colored people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a problem with that. If we take the time to talk about Italians as Italians, French as French, British as British, we should speak about people as Mexicans, Colombians, Cubans.
Not as Latinos.
No, not as Latinos and not as this, because there is so much difference between a Cuban background to an Argentinian background. Argentina is like another world, you know? It's very different. But just because we speak Spanish, we don't say Europeans generally.
Yeah. Well, no, you're hitting. So the premise of the show, right, was like, Sharon and I, how do we, through understanding of individual experiences, that's in my mind how we quote unquote solve racism, right? Like Jerry Seinfeld once said, I never understand racism. Why hate a whole group of people when you can hate an individual?
Yeah.
And I always thought that was really profound because, same thing, man. Like my wife is Chinese American and I'm Indian and we're both Asians, but man, there's night and day between
those
two.
Of course.
And then, and going to India and like the difference between a Punjabi and a Gujarati and a someone who speaks Telugu.
Yeah.
There's this tapestry, right? But one thing I do acknowledge is we're all a majority in some cases and we're all a minority, right? So I'm a straight male who's not a Muslim, right? Like there's a lot of majority stuff there. But there's a minority in the sense that when I go to the airport with my beard, right? Sometimes as a kid, because I was trying to acclimate into Alabama where I grew up, you know, I thought of myself as a white guy because I listen to Weezer and the Beatles, right?
Right, right.
And when I'm about to go back to India with my daughter and I'm going to stand out like a sore thumb, even though I'm surrounded by my people.
Right.
And actually I want to ask that's to kind of shift gears completely. What's been the reaction to your book? So you've been working on this for 10 or 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Your family's known. And when I say your family, I mean your parents, your sister, not just your wife and kids, right? Before the book came out, before the reception came out, what did people think about you working on this and what little they were seeing of this?
I don't think that they, my family is not really in the details of what I do. Fortunately, there's never been that much. I mean, they know that I'm an artist, but I'm their son and they just want me home to hang out and like eat.
Yeah.
It is not, oh, you're working on a book. Yeah. Okay. You know, but it is not their main focus. So I interview them. I ask them questions. I say, I'm working on something and then I'll call them again. I have a question. Hey, who was that guy that came to our house that day? So, oh, that's such and such, you know, I'm doing this for the book, but they didn't really know the entire, you know, thrust of the book or how it was all playing. But you know, now that they're looking at it, they just go, they're like, yeah, accurate. That happened. Yes. They're loving the sort of the attention it's gotten and they're having fun with it. And even, you know, the stuff that's in here that's controversial, my mom hasn't called me mad about anything. She's like, no, it's okay. You know, like they're very, if things occurred in life, they're okay talking about it and they can.
Yeah. You're being truthful.
Yeah. As long as it's correct. And there are some times where, you know, I depicted it sometimes badly, you know, something that occurred and my mom's like, oh, you don't understand. It was much worse than that. This other thing happened. I'm like, oh, wow. You didn't tell me.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's even more that's triggered in their minds now. Once they've read it, they're like, oh yeah. And then that other thing occurred. So
as I read in the book, you have two girls, right?
Yeah.
How old are they now?
They're 19 and 14.
Okay. Yeah, you're in it then right now. What's been their reaction to the book?
They loved it. I mean, my 19-year-old, my 19-year-old helped me finish coloring a lot of this stuff. She was really in the middle of working with me for part of it before she had to go back to college. She's going to art school too. And yeah, they've been fans of graphic novels for a long time. So the fact that I made one and that they're in it in a couple
that's
of pages,
cool.
You know, they really got a kick out of that. And I really did want to create something that became, you know, a document for them, a place where they would see their great grandparents and their grandparents and a place for them to learn some of their own history. Having grown up here, they don't really have that much of a direct connection to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And lately, especially my older daughter has gotten much more interested in the details and history and traditions of Cuba. And it's been nice to see.
Yeah. In the book, you share a moment when you took them back to Cuba, I think maybe a couple of times.
Yeah.
How old were they on their first trip back?
I think that was in 2014. So they were probably about 10 and 6 around there.
Yeah.
Or 10 and 5. Yeah, and it was quite a, you know, an adventure.
It's funny because I'm about to take my daughter, who's almost 8, taking her back to India in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And my first trip to India was when I was 6.
Okay.
And I'm just curious, what was their reaction? Obviously, and you depict the environment that they experience, right? The people they see, the family they see, the socioeconomic conditions. What was their reaction to that coming from, you know, the suburbs of the tri-state area?
Yeah, I think they were kind of okay with Havana, with the city. But when I took them to the countryside, to my town, to El Gabriel, it was like a day and they were like, this is crazy. Because they had never seen so many like wild animals roaming around, you know, dogs and cows and bulls. There are no paved streets, so everything's just dirt and, you know, the muck of houses, you know, leaching out, you know, who knows what, sewage or whatever. So I had the younger one, she was five. I had to carry her on my shoulders throughout town. Wow. She would not walk. She's like, no, I don't want to. No, the floor is dirty. Mm. And it is a result of growing up in, you know, suburban America where everything's super duper clean, which is also, you know, the main thing I noticed when I arrived in this country, how everything is so prim and proper. And it's not like that in my town at all. But one of the things that I noticed, we were just at my family's house one night, right? I was doing an exhibit in Havana in the city, and I took the car, a bus to our town, and we're going to stay there overnight. And in the middle of the night, around 3 a.m, I'm awakened by my 5-year-old with like really severe stomach pains, and she was crying. And I called my aunt. I said, we have to take her to the clinic. And she just goes, Del, what clinic?
Wow.
I'm like, we don't have a clinic in town anymore. And I said, okay, well then the hospital. I was like, well, the hospital is about, you know, 4 towns over, and there are no cars to take you at this time. So it was for the first time I got like this sense of what it was like to live in this place with a little kid, which is what my parents experienced of me doing that. I was sick all the time when I was a kid because I was in the streets eating who knows what. And that tension of having a kid and not having a car to take them somewhere, not having a clinic in town, it's very tense, you know. It's a very difficult experience to raise children, you know, in those environments.
I would imagine that their perspective on the world changed after that trip.
Yeah. No, they really, it was great to bring them because they have they immediately got a bigger appreciation for what they have here.
Yeah.
And not just the things, but also the freedoms and the way we function. They got hints and I explained to them, look, you know, that's the military watching over the crowd.
Yeah.
Every, you know, in the plazas, there were police and military installed there. So they got a sense of what that was like.
Yeah, you know, I like to say sometimes, and I was born here, right? But like, if you live in the West, and it's not a judgment call, but like kind of won the genetic lottery in terms of those freedoms or those things that we really do take for granted until you can see it, right? Like my first trip to India when I was 6, you know, I'd been to Venezuela and seen the machine guns at the airport. And
yeah,
but at the same time, you know, sometimes I'm at Grand Central in New York City. And, you know, you see the National Guardsmen with machine guns too. And I'm like,
right. Yeah. And that's actually surprising when that happens. You're like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
But the reasons are different.
Yeah.
Generally.
But what I was saying is like those images don't exist in this country, you know? But then when you see National Guardsmen at the Capitol in front of metal.
Yeah. Well, and that's what was so upsetting to me is basically seeing, you know, what I grew up with. But there is a lot of, I have conversations with my friends here and like, what do you mean? We're being spied on all the time. I'm like, listen, you don't understand what being spied on all the time actually is.
Yeah. It's one thing to be spied on for selling you advertising.
Yes.
It's another thing.
Yes. And it's just anytime people do things like that, it just generally bothers me because you're diminishing what actual, you know, dictatorship or the actual things that are happening in places like Burma or Pakistan. Venezuela by saying, well, I feel like I'm being, you know, spied on constantly. No, it's different.
You don't know. Yeah. What's one thing that your kids would say they've learned about you or learned from you?
Well, I think that the thing that I try to pass down and I think they picked up on is this idea of believing that you know, if you just do your work and you do what you feel is right and where you're passionate about, things work out. And I think that's my main focus is not getting too concerned about where life is going. Just function and be good to other people and be honest with your work and things will happen like kismet, like things were meant to be.
Yeah.
I try to get that across to them as much as possible.
And I know NPR totally stole this question that we ask all of our guests, mm-hmm. but if you could go back and talk to that little boy in El Gabriel, you know, who doesn't know what's in front of him with boats and with art school and with magazine covers. What would you tell that little boy?
You know, I think that it's just to let him know that things are going to be all right. If you just keep at it, if you keep doing what you want to do, which again is what I try to get across to my kid. I was very scared, concerned, wondering what was going to happen to me once I arrived here, and then what I was going to become as an adult. My main focus, you know, once I arrived here and having gone through so many questions and interviews or dealt with this book, I've thought about this a bit more, why I made this, you know. And my main thing was that I did not want everything that I had lost to be in vain. Mm-hmm. I lost my grandparents, I lost my family, I lost my friends, and I didn't want to come here and not make something with that, right? So since I was about 9-10 years old, I was the most, you know, I went to every class. I tried to get the best grades. I was thinking so much about who I was going to become. I wanted to become something. I didn't want to have lost my entire family and then done nothing with it. So everything you see, if you see my book, if you see other things, it is sort of like honoring what happened to my family and why it was split up, and trying to make the experience and the difficulties worth something.
And I want to shift gears a little bit. If we've got a few more minutes, do you want to have a little fun and do a little bit of a speed round?
Sure, yeah.
All right. And these are just meant to be some fun questions, mm-hmm, as we race towards the end of our chat. What's one thing about you that no one expects?
That I'm funny. Everyone thinks I'm an angry political, and I'm just an idiot most of the time.
That's awesome. What's a book or a movie that has characters that you relate to?
Book was Night by Elie Wiesel, and a movie was Cinema Paradiso. That film really made an impact on me when I was younger.
Nice. When did you see that? How old were you?
I was in college, actually. I was I think freshman year of college, and at the cinema at Pratt, and I started bawling, crying.
What's your favorite mom dish?
Oh, oxtail stew.
What's your least favorite food?
Oh, my least favorite food? Oh, it'd just be like a bad sandwich or something.
Have you seen the meme on the Chinese social media where they're making fun of what Americans eat for lunch?
Well, I know. I did try. My agent, God love her, she's like, you really, took me to a sushi restaurant to celebrate the book. And she's an expert at this stuff. She's like, have you tried urchin? I'm like, no. She's like, you got to try it. And I tried it. It was awful. Yeah. So I'd say urchin now.
Okay. Who's someone out there that you would want to talk to on a podcast?
Someone out there that I would want to talk to on a podcast. I always, my heroes are artists, you know? Yeah. So I would probably say David Hockney.
Well, why would you want to talk to him, or what would you ask him?
I've been inspired by him since I was in college, and the way he thinks, the way he changes, the way he works, you know, and I have a lot of respect. I think he's about 85 now.
Yeah.
Just how he just keeps on going. He doesn't stop.
Yeah.
And I it's the kind of thing that I would like to do in my life, is just continue making art.
Last question. And I know you take a little umbrage with this term, but what does being a modern minority mean for you?
I don't really know. I mean, I think possibly it's just that the word minority feels like, you know, of the past or something. And
yeah,
we are becoming very powerful. So at what time do we, and that's where the modern comes, right? To me.
Yeah.
The word modern becomes like we're taking over. We're making companies. We're basically living our lives. And maybe at some point we'll drop the minority thing and just become people that are running things, I don't like in general dividing people up into this group or that group, I want to just, you know, be all Americans or Cuban American, Indian American, or whatever it is. But we're all in this together, and I think once you figure that out, you're going to solve a lot of problems here in the United States and in many other places.
That's the right answer, man. that's amazing. You know, thank you. Literally, I only discovered your book somehow in the last few weeks. I read it a couple of days ago. It's arguably the best book I've read this year. And now I'm a fan of just your work and your take. And just thank you for continuing to put this sort of stuff out there. It means a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And that's our show.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, leave a review, and a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting platform.
Now more than ever, people need to be hearing these stories. Please share our show with a friend or three.
Want to learn more or got something to share? Visit modmypod.com or email us, hi mom@modmypod.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter @modminpod. We'd love to hear from you.
That's it for now. I've been Ramin Segal.
And I'm still Sharon Lee Tony.
Remember, we're all modern minorities out there.
We'll talk to you soon.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.